The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. First off, thank you for coming to this lecture, which was one of, is one of several talks to feature the word worldview in its title being offered this year. The importance of worldview and of teaching a classical and Christian worldview is abundantly obvious in how the word has captured the ACCS imagination. A number of things that I'm interested in talking about follow up rather nicely on Dr. Grant's very excellent lecture this morning. I'll confess to being a little nervous when Dr. Grant started with grad grind, though, because that's where I'm starting from as well, and I this vertigo kind of feeling that I could hear him saying my whole lecture in the first few minutes. Just have to do stand-up this afternoon. Worldview is a word with a host of definitions, although I don't think there's a need to choose one over another. A worldview is a lens through which the world is seen and interpreted. A worldview is a set of presuppositions, those ultimate and unprovable beliefs to which no other belief can come prior, but from which all other belief is derived. While we are in agreement that worldview must be taught, how and why we teach the supremacy of the Christian worldview is an entirely different matter. Further, how we teach students to understand other worldviews is a matter to chew on. I'd submit to you that it is possible to teach students the facts and tenets and propositions of a Christian worldview without the student ever gaining one for themselves or learning how to live out a Christian worldview. It is possible to teach worldview the same way that Professor Gradgrind teaches his students what a horse is in hard times. What I want is the facts, says Gradgrind, and while Sissy, the daughter of a local horse trainer, begins to wax poetic about horses, Gradgrind cuts her off, preferring the boy Bitzer, who defines a horse as quadruped, graminivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, and so forth. In his excellent treatise on classical education, Poetic Knowledge, The Recovery of Education, a book which Christine Perrin mentioned this morning in her excellent lecture on poetry, James S. Taylor begins with that account of Gradgrind from Dickens to describe the difference between scientific knowledge and poetic knowledge. Without denigrating science, Taylor suggests that scientific knowledge is knowledge from the outside in. The student comes to know the studied object as other, different, alien, factual. Poetic knowledge, on the other hand, is personal. It is knowledge from the inside out. Poetic knowledge aims to know a person or thing by seeing the world as that person or thing sees it. Poetic knowledge seeks union with a person, sympathy for that person, the kind of knowledge shared by close friends, who know one another's sins and moral triumphs down to the minutiae. Since the Enlightenment, education has come more and more to favor scientific knowledge, nearly exclusively. Neither scientific nor poetic knowledge is dispensable, yet both must be taught, and for reasons which I'll explore later, poetic knowledge must come first. Poetic knowledge often deals in abstract and vaporous theological concepts like being and telos. Modern education tends to eschew any method of knowing which cannot boast quantifiable certainty or mathematical clarity. The perfect removal of the experimenter from the experiment. That's modern knowledge. Or the removal of the teacher from the text. A text well taught is one where the teacher plays no role whatsoever. I'll explain that more later. Poetic knowledge, however, is concerned with the emotions and with the spirit and with a sense of wonder and mystery, intrigue, humanity, personality. Poetic knowledge is more like the knowledge of the naturalist, the bird watcher, or the man who wanders around a zoo for hours, gazing at the animals, delighted to see their strangeness. Scientific knowledge dissects, catalogs, quantifies and looks for similarities, deducing a family and a species. Poetic knowledge is interested in all the ways that this particular bird is not like the other birds, in all the ways that this writer is not like other writers. Scientific knowledge is interested in categorizing, and poetic knowledge is interested in all the ways that a thing can't be categorized because of its uniqueness. No small part of the draw of modern education is its promise to be done with messiness, debatability, and interpretation, which arises from poetic knowledge, which arises from personality. The perfect, enlightened, modern law is that law which is mathematically precise, sub-intellectual, without any need for nuance or exception, context, or situation. X is never allowed. Y is always allowed. A law which even a machine could adjudicate. From a certain angle, the appeal of such a thing is obvious. To put it bluntly, scientific knowledge gets stuff done. Dante's geocentric cosmology might be beautiful in theory, but heliocentrism put a man on the moon. Within the paradigm of modern education, the work of the teacher is regular, verifiable. We know the teacher put the right thoughts in the students' heads, and that he did not affect the right thoughts with his flawed personality because the students were able to reproduce the facts when tested. Knowledge is a kind of iTunes playlist. The mind is a blank CD, and we will know the CD has been burned properly when the music it yields is indistinguishable from the playlist. Too often, though, worldview is taught in the exact same manner. The teacher prepares to teach a work of literature. Let us say the Communist Manifesto. The teacher introduces the book by writing out a definition of materialism, a series of abstract propositions which any materialist would uphold. The book is then read, or perhaps just a few objectionable passages are read, and the teacher directs the students to statements made by Marx which are consistent with the propositions previously identified as materialism. Those statements are then briefly compared with a few passages of scripture, dismissed as unscriptural, and the book has been taught. The materialist worldview has been described, revealed, dismissed. The same process might be repeated with any other work. The tenets of Romanticism are described. Frankenstein is passed out. Passages of the text, which neatly correspond to those tenets, are highlighted, briefly compared with decontextualized quotes from St. Paul, and the book is laid to rest. Why read these books at all if we're only going to cursorily dismiss them as false? Often enough, the answer is we are plundering the Egyptians. While these books are portrayed as philosophically worthless, we can borrow a neat turn of phrase here, a one-off apt observation of human nature there. We can admire the character development or the structure, and there are times when plundering the Egyptians threatens to become the sole metaphor we have to understand why we read old books. It may even be hard for us to describe why we read old Christian authors apart from this metaphor, given that we don't agree entirely with anybody but ourselves. The only difference between the student's approach to Anselm and Whitman is the quantity of stuff to plunder. It's hard for a student to be truly a student in such an educational environment, because the student is never encouraged to learn, but simply to analyze and judge. Every text is either a friend or an enemy. If the book is a friend, it stands merely to confirm our beliefs about the world. If the text is an enemy, any beliefs in the book contrary to our own may be dismissed prior to reading it. The student, in this manner, is encouraged to become a kind of intellectual goalie. The author of a text will shoot idea pucks at you, and if you're a good student, you'll deflect them all from the net of your mind and learn almost nothing. At best, you will hone your skill. Anything the student takes away from a reading might be nothing more than the recognition of the enemy's passion or technical proficiency. This approach to education will not gift the world with lifelong learners. Learning, redeeming, and recreating are sloughed off for superficial criticism, and as the Finnish composer Jean Sibelius once said, no statue has ever been erected for a critic. Creators are lovers. The creator loves a thing so much that he wants to make his own. Creation is prompted by love, by a desire to wonder and so to know. It's the same impulse which prompts a man to wonder at a woman, to pursue, to marry that woman, to know that woman, and to gift the world with living images of the love he has for that woman. Let me suggest that the Christian worldview, what it is, how it is presented, and how it is lived out, ought to begin with two of the fundamental doctrines and realities of Christianity, the triune nature of God and the dual nature of Christ. God is and reveals himself as a community of three persons. No person in the Trinity can be known apart from his relationship to the other two. We know the Son as the Son because he has a Father. We know the Father as a Father because he has a Son. We know the Father and the Son love one another because of their bond together in the Spirit. Each person of the Trinity enjoys an infinitely deep, expansive, and perfect relationship with the others. God is truth, and truth is communal, relational, personal. Because God loves man, he gives the Son to us. The Son is the only name given to man that man might know God. And when the Father gives the Son, he gives us the Son not as an idea or a presupposition or a platonic form. The Son is born a man, Jesus Christ. Jesus tells us that he is truth itself, himself. Truth is a man, a person, who spoke and walked and ate. And when God wanted to present himself fully, he sent a man. We can't understand God fully as a pure idea, but as an idea mediated fully and finally through the human being, Jesus. When teachers leap to abstraction, they rob the student of the intimacy of understanding for themselves the fullness of what a book offers about the ideas in its own particular incarnation. Ideas, in that scenario, simply become empty placeholders without the particularities that fill them up, without those human particularities that fill them up. When we know the truth, Christ, we know a man, a person, and if we are to live and learn in a manner which respects and loves the means by which God gives us full knowledge of the truth, we must know men, women, children. We must know and relate to persons. James S. Taylor, writes, funny if it was the fire and rain guys, St. Augustine understood very well that we are first drawn to contemplation of reality by a sense of wonder, pleasurable in some way, when we are motivated to know through our senses within the general appetite of love. Knowledge begins with wonder, and wonder is both pleasurable and painful. Knowledge is pleasurable in that the object of wonder is perceived, and it is arresting, captivating, land. Wonder is painful inasmuch as we only wonder at that which we don't entirely understand, and that ignorance is disturbing. Of course, that ignorance spurs us to want to know for its own sake, not because we are coerced into doing so. When Marx or Shelley or Anselm is reduced to a series of abstractions, there's little to wonder at, little to excite the student into desiring to know. People are interesting, though. When asked about the meaning of his poem, The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot simply began reciting the poem. If the meaning, this is something that Christine Perrin made a fine point of this morning, I'm just following up on this. If the meaning were simpler and easier to grasp than the text itself, you'd just write that. But no, the author has written the meaning, and it is the text. The meaning is the text. On some level, the text is the analysis, and the analysis is the text. If you want to know what it means, you have to read it. We must analyze, eventually, but we must analyze something we understand. So how do we present the authors of great works of literature as people? How do we relate to them? How do we avoid reducing them to a series of abstractions? If Shelley is nothing but a romantic, and Coleridge is nothing but a romantic, what does it matter which one of them we read? And if neither Shelley nor Coleridge is anything other than a placeholder for romanticism, why not simply study the abstract tenets? Why read any books at all? Referring back to the handout for a moment, I've suggested three particular ways of thinking about the role of the teacher. The teacher must be a stage setter, the teacher must play the author, and the teacher must be a provocateur. And I'd like to address these roles in that order. To properly set the stage for a student to encounter a book requires thorough preparation and study on the part of the teacher. The teacher should be ready to explain the philosophical, moral, and social convictions of the author's era and establish some historical framework for those convictions so that the student knows how those convictions emerged, were established, and handed down across generations. The teacher should also be able to talk about the economic conditions which beset the country or city of the author and describe the prevailing religious and denominational realities the author would have known. The student should understand where the author came from and where the author's beliefs came from. The goal is not to inundate students with facts, but to show how the facts form a peopled landscape of which the author, through the text, provides one particular vantage point, a view not only of the peopled landscape, but of himself, the author, as well. There are an unfortunate number of students who graduate from Christian high schools having never asked where the apparently strange beliefs of their cultural ancestors came from. Or if they asked, they received a monolithic answer. Why did the medievals believe the earth was at the center of the universe? Why did Dante believe in purgatory? Why did Karl Marx believe that the communist revolution would be the last? Too often, the teacher does not know the answer to these questions, and so they simply say, why do they believe these things? Because their understanding was darkened. They didn't know the true God. Ironically, the student who graduates without a well-set stage is led to believe that a man does not reap what he has sown, that one generation does not harvest what the previous generation has planted, and that there is no such thing as inheritance. History is not a story, but a chaos of fools bumbling around, inexplicably doing and thinking and believing nonsensical things over and over again until 33 AD or 312 AD or 1776 or 1880, one when things began to get normal. The student does not see the human being as an emotional, rational, irrational, sentimental, calculating, crafty, scheming, artistic, devastated, hopeful, ignorant, wise, misunderstood, understandable, deliberate, accidental, shameful, helpful, virtuous, vicious, terrified, loving, hating, responding, relating creature made in God's image, but an object and a beast which is often wrong. The student graduates with a thoroughly secular, enlightened understanding of history. everyone who came before us, me, was wrong, but we have got things pretty much figured out. This is not a student with a sense of sublime wonder for the world and the God revealed therein. This is not a student who has an interest in encountering traditions and creeds and old ideas and old men and old women. Rather, this is someone who has thrown their lot in with the small and arrogant oligarchy of those who merely happen to be walking around, as Chesterton once put it. Rather than growing gracious cultivators, we assemble critics who disdain. While a chronological ordering of your curriculum might seem dull, every new book you teach must stand on the shoulders of the last book you taught. Let's say that in a year, you must teach the Gospel of Mark, the City of God, and the Song of Roland. Nearly 400 years elapsed between Mark and Augustine, and nearly 400 years elapsed between Augustine and the historical Roland. In order to teach Mark on an academic level, the teacher needs to have a fine understanding of the pagan world Christ entered, pagan philosophies, anxieties, hopes. It seems impossible that Mark's gospel could be taught without a prior knowledge of Homer and Virgil. But also the political relationship between the Jews and Romans must be understood, the advent of the Pharisees 2 centuries earlier, and so forth. When Mark's gospel is finished, there's no neat, clean line to Augustine. The age of martyrs must be described, as well as the logic behind killing Christians, as any good Roman politico would have explained it to you. Reasons for the financial collapse of Rome in the 3rd century must be understood before the anxiety against Christians which gave rise to martyrdom will make sense. The dynamic turn of fate afforded Rome by Constantine should be presented, as well as the resulting utopian fantasies many Christians succumbed to for the next 100 years. Prior to teaching the City of God, the student should understand how the fall of Rome broke the politically progressive Christian ambition of Augustine's day, and how this break changed and sharpened and refined Christian eschatology into a thing of sublime beauty in the coming centuries. Only then will the invectives against pagan Rome, which opened the City of God, really make any sense. But there's no clean line between Augustine and Roland. After the City of God is closed, much groundwork is needed before opening Roland. Why does Roland's world not seem much like Augustine's? While Augustine is dismissive of the importance of the civil realm, Roland and Charlemagne are willing to die for it. Yet they claim they're dying for God as they do. Why? No glossing description of feudalism is going to cover it. Where did feudalism come from? Why? Is feudalism related to the medieval worship of order, systems, and hierarchy? Is a richly hierarchical earth related to a hierarchical cosmos as well? If the teacher never feels absolutely overwhelmed, even if only for an hour, at the thought of transitioning from the late antique to the early medieval, the teacher will likely have a comic strip landscape in which to present the book, not a colorful vista worthy of a student's consideration. Of course, there are ways of teaching a book to avoid these kind of difficult questions. We all know this. Most students, often enough, are willing to settle for shapeless answers. We reduce the Pharisees to a kind of faceless group of thugs who hate Jesus because they're greedy. Or we might say Augustine and Roland disagree on the importance of the civil realm because, well, Christians disagree about these things sometimes. Oh, okay. In a bind, we all give these non-answers from time to time, but it ought to bother us because there's nothing classical about it at all. Such answers do not inspire a love of learning other people's thoughts. They simply confirm our own superiority to ourselves. The stage is set to read a book by presenting the world of the author in such a way that the student can hear words as the author would have heard them and used them. When Augustine speaks of freedom, he means something very different than Rousseau meant. Why? What conditioned Augustine theologically, philosophically? Augustine became fascinated with Christianity after he read the story of St. Anthony of Egypt, moving to the desert. St. Anthony's renunciation of worldly goods looms large in Augustine's imagination whenever he discusses earthly mindedness. Of course, Rousseau believed that virtue was only obtainable through a human society, which would force you to remain true to your ideals even if you had to suffer for them. Augustine believed virtue might be sought in solitude. Would this not dramatically change what either men meant when they spoke of freedom? Or worse, without an adequate image, the student may substitute a false one and completely miss the point, as you'll see in a moment in a discussion of Frankenstein. The stage is set to read a book by presenting the world of the author in such a way that the ambient cultural anxieties and prejudices of anyone living around the author might be understood. This will help the student understand the extent to which an author was a product of their time or a reformer. Jane Austen's critiques of aristocratic anxieties is probably neither as vehement as a modern American would like, nor as mild as a living, breathing Mr. Collins would have. When Austen wrote of the aristocracy, she wrote precisely, carefully, often resisting the broad brush in favor of small, incisive comments about hubris and mammon. She wrote at the beginning of the 19th century, when the enlightened and revolutionary cultural winds of France had begun to prevail in England as well. In presenting a mild critique of aristocracy, Austen avoided the call for revolt from Enlightenment sympathizers in England, and yet she would not irrationally venerate old money for its own sake. Of course, Pride and Prejudice can be taught without reference to any of that. But the student will neither fully understand nor sympathize with the author apart from a working knowledge of the political and social concerns of their day. I have a list of resources up here. I meant to pass them out before this started, but up here, which please grab one before you leave. The list of resources I've given on this handout is not really groundbreaking. Chances are at least a few of these books are already on your shelves. Thanks, Mr. Butcher. Perhaps I could suggest using these books in a slightly different way than they've been used before. As opposed to using Leo Strauss's History of Political Philosophy as a political philosophy text, use it as a helpmate for teaching fiction. If you've little knowledge of French revolutionary philosophy, acquainting yourself with the essay on Rousseau's thoughts will be helpful in piecing together the kind of thing Mary Shelley's father taught her when she was a girl. If you've little knowledge of the debates going on in England at the time Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice, reading a summary of the chief political theorist of her day, Edmund Burke, can acquaint you with the arguments and anxieties which had come to bear on Jane Austen. Reading the article on Plato and Strauss can put you in touch with the beliefs of the Fox from Till We Have Faces. In a similar way, the Oxford History of Christianity is an excellent resource for understanding the religious and denominational convictions of an era. Yaroslav Pelikan's Jesus Through the Centuries is very good for this as well. These are books written by inquisitive, studied men who offer a kind of sympathy and critique of historical epochs which can only be gained through an interior knowledge of them. The Oxford History of Christianity is a series of 20 to 30 page essays written by scholars who identify personally and creedally with the persons they're describing. That's who you want to talk to. The chapter on the Reformation is written by a Lutheran, the chapter on the Counter-Reformation is written by a Catholic, and so forth. Before teaching Pride and Prejudice, the teacher can acquire a fair knowledge of Anglican convictions of the early 19th century, as well as a familiarity with the failures, successes, and concerns Anglicans lived through. This knowledge can open up the characters of a Jane Austen book, characters which might otherwise seem to do nothing but bite their nails at the prospect of moving out of a 10-room mansion into a 6-room townhouse. I've tried to list books that have been helpful to me in humanizing authors and understanding them. The key here is not dropping 3 hours of introductory lectures on your students before cracking a book, though, but rather, page by page, explaining the cultural conditions of the author as the text gives rise to those questions in the mind of the student. Great books are often enough, not great because they make a simple kind of sense once and for all the first time you read them, but because they must be pored over, and when they are pored over, they continually yield new levels of insight. This means that often enough, great books are filled with rather bizarre claims from which students initially recoil. Think of your own early encounters with an ideology that you did not believe, and yet came to believe. Think of your own early encounters with an ideology that seemed strange to you, but acceptable, and yet over the course of time you found its wickedness. often enough, we accept or reject new ideas because they are beautiful or ugly, and a rational defense or debunking comes only after we have gazed in wonder at a thing qua thing, not a thing qua idea. The second role of the literature teacher is that of the author of the literature studied. The teacher stands in for the author, playing the role of the author. The teacher defends the rationality and coherence of the book, sometimes to an incredulous classroom, but more often to an engaged classroom. Why engaged? When the teacher plays the role of the author, the goal is to transcend the limitations of time and so to stage an encounter, a conversation between the student and the author, whether the author is Augustine, Luther, or Marx. It is true that ideas have consequences, but ideas come from particular people who come from particular parents, born in particular cities, ruled by particular laws, born out of particular religious convictions. And religious convictions are both the beginning and end of society, where it comes from and where it's going. The ideas of an author can be annexed from that author, his family, his nation, his other works. But if we do this, we reduce it to mere propositions, we're not really understanding the author and his text, or the people who read the book and loved it or hated it. We're understanding ideas that we might as well have made up from scratch. The author is not necessary. If ideas can be divorced from an author, then ideas can be divorced from a book, and there's no point in reading the book. Enlightened education is comfortable with this, though, and has simply replaced books with textbooks, which are not really books. When we think of worldview, we ought not restrict ourselves to a set of ideas and propositions, though. Obviously, ideas and propositions are a major aspect of what worldview means. By viewing a book as an incarnation of ideas rather than a placeholder that could be shuffled in, shuffled out, by viewing a book as an incarnation of ideas and not a placeholder, its worldview, the worldview of the book, takes on shape and color and tone and timbre. We begin to think of a man's parents as part of a worldview. What a man eats is part of his worldview. A man's worldview is changed by the loss of a sibling, by bearing witness to an execution, by losing the tip of a finger in a kitchen accident. We often think that a man's worldview affects what he eats, which is true, but we fail to grasp that what a man eats affects his worldview. We manipulate our surroundings and act according to worldview, but our eyes are omnivorous, and we are constantly devouring, consciously and subconsciously, ideas which pour into us. Oftentimes, when we think of a Marxist or a romantic or a secularist, we're not thinking of a human being, but an avatar of an idea. It's only when we speak of a romantic who is also an orphan and an American and a jilted lover that a romantic can really take on meaning. The peculiarities bring definition to the generalization. A generalization devoid of peculiarities and particularities is meaningless, it's worthless. The example I almost always use with my students is in poetry class. We talk about the importance of specificity. I say you were to come home one day and tell your parents, Mr. Gibbs was very mean in class today. What's the first question your parents are going to ask? What did he do? Now, if you tell them, he was just mean. Just a bad guy. Your parents would probably be concerned and say, oh, gracious, like, what did he say? He's just mean. Like, how? Did he say something cruel? That's just mean. Like, you don't believe somebody who does that. Like, if they can't give you a particularity or peculiarity, it's the generalization, oh, just mean. Who can believe that? We believe details. The devil's not in the generalization. Thus, for the teacher to play the role of the author, the teacher must be able to set the scene, but they also need to describe the particulars of the author's life. Not every great author is purely a product of their time. Many are contrarians, revolutionaries, reformers. In one sense, the prophet Jeremiah was a product of his time, but in another sense, prophets are just cut from a different cloth. Begin by reading a biography. The 3-page biography which prefaces the introduction is not good enough, although it's better than nothing. Read deeply of the author's life, and then read the introduction at the beginning of that Penguin Classics edition slowly out loud to your class, filling in details the intro doesn't have time to linger on. Skipping the biographical introduction can give students a false understanding of how a man develops the kind of mind which produces a work of literature that survives the gauntlet of time. Without a somewhat intimate biography, the student comes to believe that great minds just fall from the sky. Save details of the biography for pertinent passages of the book you're studying. Slowly dispense them, and allow the author to take shape in the student's mind even as the argument of the book unfolds. Let the idea be known as the man is known, and the man is the idea. A good teacher is like a good conductor. A sense of timing and space and proportion, dynamics and volume are all just as essential when presenting a man, an ideology, or a book as they are to music, playing music. Leave place for the student's anticipation, supposition, refutation, reformulation. A lousy musician might ignore rhythm and all the empty spaces between notes, simply playing every note on the page as fast and loud as possible. You can teach a book that same way. A teacher might blast information at students with no sense of proportion or volume, emphasis, timing, flattening a text into pure abstraction, stealing away the opportunity for enjoyment and discovery. You think about this, that when you reduce a book to a series of abstractions, there's no place for discovery. You're never going to read a passage in the book and be like, wow, what that? Didn't expect that. Nope, you expected it. I told you it was coming. You know it's wrong. There it is. I'm just done. So learn the author, collect narratives and quotes and pictures and tidbits about them, and reveal the author in the text as the text calls for personal elucidation and clarification. If you're reading a book by Leo Tolstoy and your students never see a picture of Tolstoy as a young aristocrat rakishly sitting for his portrait, arm confidently hung over the back of his chair, or if they never see a picture of him as an old man, austere with a thick white beard and pinpointing gaze, they're not going to understand the death of Ivan Ilyich. Finally, the teacher is a provocateur. By this, I mean the teacher is regularly looking to unsettle students of their ease with a book or their dismissal of it. When the student seems to fall too neatly in line with the claims of an author, the teacher tries more devoutly to stir the student from complacency. When the student dismisses a work, whether contemplatively or intuitively, the teacher uses the text to try to dislodge a few of the student's presuppositions and prejudices, not so the student may throw them away, but that the student might examine them all the more closely. Some of our most cherished beliefs are ones we can barely give voice to. They are so much a part of us as our own faces are, and we can never see them truly, but only in reflection. A good student will oscillate back and forth between passive reception and active engagement. The student who is trying to think of something clever to say while he's reading a book isn't going to get much. In Proverbs 18, Solomon writes, "He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him." Later, Solomon writes, "In a lawsuit, the first to speak seems right until someone comes forward and cross-examines." This doesn't mean that the first to speak is always wrong, but that a thorough cross-examination is necessary in all judicial matters. Furthermore, we deny Solomon, we deny Scripture, if we ask our students to condemn or approve a work before they've heard it speak on its own behalf. It might seem safer to hand a student a copy of the Communist Manifesto and preface it with, "This is all a bunch of lies, don't believe it." But Solomon commands that we must hear and so contemplate and ruminate before we grant a verdict, lest we fall prey to folly. So what might this all look like? I'd like to paint a picture of what this approach to teaching lit could look like and use Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as an example, given how common the book seems to be within the ACCS orbit. Obviously, I can't speak for all, but let me very briefly describe the reductionist, enlightened, grad grind way of teaching such a book, modern way of teaching it. Frankenstein was published in 1818, a year that falls between 1800 and 1850, which are commonly given as bookends on Wikipedia for the Romantic period. Given that the book is not apparently thoroughgoingly Christian, it must be a work of Romanticism. Romanticism glorifies nature, the freedom and perfect liberty of the spirit, distant things, exotic things. It's four. You know what the first four questions on the quiz is going to be now. Romanticism holds to the goodness of the savage, the infant, and the uncivilized man. Romanticism is spiritualistic and irrational, distrustful of science. Now, if you read Frankenstein, you're going to find all of that there. You'll find characters who believe in spirits, but not in the true gods, and spiritualistic. You'll find that science and technology unleash a monster on the world. You'll find a narrative eye which gazes at Eastern religions and a glorious depiction of Frankenstein's monster as a young savage, untainted by civilization, free and innocent. You'll find numerous passages wherein the characters go off for long pastoral gambols in the mountains for consolation, solace, and wisdom. Now, at the same time, the better you know Mary Shelley, the more you know that none of those apparent romantic qualities represent the book at all. To know Shelley as a woman is to know the book as a lachrymose reprimand of her good-for-nothing husband, Percy, who is simply the character Victor Frankenstein by a different name. In order to understand a work which comes so late in the Western tradition as Frankenstein, the teacher must present the legacy of the great Western tradition up until the Romantics. The Romantics loved savages, drugs, promiscuity, oriental things, mysterious things, and nature, especially when nature was at her most uncontrollable. Romantic painters loved to depict massive shipping vessels being battered by the chaos of a storm. Romantic painters loved to show the ruins of castles and monasteries. But why? What prompted the Romantics to such convictions? If we assume the Romantics were rebelling against Christian beliefs and convictions, it would be a rather tough case to make. If we're going to leave it at that. It would be far easier to show the Romantics were responding to the Enlightenment and her sympathizers. The political power of Christianity had substantially waned by the 19th century in the aftermath of the Revolution, which saw an open and honest attempt to strip all vestiges of Christianity from Paris and beyond. And yet, what prompted Enlightenment sympathizers to their desire for a neat, clean world, a world free from messiness? Why? To answer that question, we might begin working our way back through history, the wars of religion which resulted from the Reformation, which resulted from the Renaissance, which resulted from the birth of the city, which resulted from cathedral culture, which resulted from Carolingian reformations, which resulted from the consolidation of land taken reclaimed from Muslims, and so on and so forth. To really fairly understand why the Romantics in 1850 liked to paint old broken castles, you've probably got to go all the way back to Let My People Go. In saying this, I do not mean to intimidate the first or second year teacher of a great books program. Not at all. I'm not saying you have to know everything before you get started. That's absurd. Work patiently. Be willing to admit that you'll be a far better teacher 5 years from now than today. And work toward that reality. Add one book of the curriculum to your repertoire of developed, humane, deeply learned texts every year. In learning one book well, one author well, you'll begin to learn other books at the same time. Because historical epochs are so connected, the man who understands the Renaissance profoundly knows quite a bit about the medievals who came before and the reformers who came after. Obviously, I'm not describing a project for an afternoon or a week, talking about 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 14 years. It's a lifelong project. Returning to the Romantics, suffice to say for now, these were people deeply disenchanted with the enlightened effort to make the world neat and clean. They didn't believe such a thing was possible, nor was it satisfying. And so they aimed at presenting a world gloriously opposed to the ideas of the Enlightenment. Mary Shelley was caught between enlightened ideals and romantic sensibilities. While her fame transcends that of her parents were celebrities in their own day. Both William Godwin, her father, and Mary Wollstonecraft, her mother, were part of a movement which sought to bring the Enlightenment, and perhaps the Revolution with it, into England. Before Mary was born, Mary Shelley, her parents attended the Newington Green Unitarian Church, where they heard Dr. Richard Price preach sermons on politics, justice, and likely give the same kind of irreligious prattle you hear from a Richard Dawkins today. Newington Green was not really a church by any fine standard of the word, but a club where the fiery Price preached against the monarchy and in favor of republicanism. It's possible that Mary and William passed Edmund Burke going in and out of church on Sunday. Burke couldn't stand Price, but was one of many who came to hear him speak just to keep his finger on the pulse of revolutionary sentiment. Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin, Mary Shelley's parents, were pamphleteers. Godwin published a book entitled Political Justice in 1793, where he called for the end of superstitious institutions like marriage, insisting on a reasonable government for man. Like many of his era, Godwin tried his hand at a host of different jobs and failed them, strapped for cash for his whole life. He was often looking for a wealthy patron, but it was hard to come by a wealthy patron because he was such an outspoken critic of the wealthy. Go figure. Mary Wollstonecraft was the author of A Vindication of the Rights of Women, a famous tract which called for the equality of women in education. Wollstonecraft died 11 days after her daughter Mary was born, and her father raised her to worship her mother. When Mary was only 9 or 10, William gave his daughter a copy of her mother's diary, and it was there that Mary learned her mother had enjoyed numerous affairs, had a child out of wedlock, and attempted suicide only 2 years prior to her birth, to Mary's birth. Godwin was untroubled by Mary knowing so much so soon. He didn't disapprove of what his wife had done. Godwin and Wollstonecraft were both meticulous chroniclers of their own lives. They wrote diaries. They kept meticulous diaries. They knew that they were famous, even in their own day. They knew that people would go on and read their work. And so most of Mary Shelley's life is known through her diary, through her father's diary. There's barely a month of her life that passes that can't be accounted for in the diary. When Mary was a teenager, she was sent to Scotland for treatment for eczema and to pass a few summers in the home of a dissenting minister, William Baxter, a friend of Godwin's from when he himself had been a dissenting Calvinist minister in his 20s before falling away. Godwin sent a letter to Baxter with his daughter telling him he wanted her to be raised as a cynic. While she was away, Godwin became friends with the famous poet Percy Bysshe Shelley. At the time they met, Percy had been expelled from Oxford for publishing a pamphlet entitled The Necessity of Atheism. It's a time when you could get kicked out of Oxford for publishing a pamphlet called The Necessity of Atheism. His father was a rich landowner and a member of Parliament. Percy was slated to inherit a fortune. And yet Percy despised money, as only a young ideologue can do. He made a commitment to Godwin, having read Political Justice when he was only a boy and been inspired by it. He promised to be Godwin's patron until the day he died. Godwin was elated. After a lifetime of failed attempts to support himself, he finally had financial security. He was a perfect match for Godwin. While Percy's wife, who's married at the age of 19, was 7 months pregnant, Percy met Mary and Godwin, her father, for dinner. 6 weeks later, with his own wife on the verge of giving birth, the 22-year-old Percy took the 17-year-old Mary to her mother's grave in the middle of the night, professed his undying love for her, and then, according to Mary's best biographers, consummated their relationship before leaving the graveyard. This is the woman who wrote Frankenstein. Seminal moments in her life. If Godwin did not approve, he did not loudly voice his anger at first. After all, Percy had just committed to support Godwin, and their relationship was staked in Percy's love for Godwin's book, Political Justice, which depicted marriage as an outdated institution. For the sake of time, I can't recount to you all that happened to Mary and Percy after they committed themselves to one another, but I can tell you that few women have been so emotionally abused by boyfriends and husbands as Mary was by Percy. The two ran off to Europe months later with Mary's stepsister Jane. Mary was already pregnant. Jane fell in love with Percy, and the two had an on-again, off-again affair for the next several years, even while Mary carried Percy's child. Percy's father all but cut him off after seeing his son's irresponsibility, and so Percy lost his ability to support Godwin, so Godwin could finally voice his disapproval of his daughter's relationship with Godwin, or with Percy. Godwin renounced his former writings. Percy Shelley returned to Harriet, his first wife, who had given birth to a son and was anxious for the boy's father to play some role in his life. Then Mary gave birth to a little girl, Clara, and the child died 11 days after she was born, likely from malnutrition, as Percy had no money to support her, and Mary had been disowned by her father. The summer before writing Frankenstein, Percy left his wife again and went to Lake Geneva to pass time with his friend Lord Byron. Mary and Jane, her sister, came along. Mary became pregnant again and gave birth to a son, William, named after her father, also the name of a very important character in Frankenstein. Toward the end of their absence in England, Mary's sister, half-sister Fanny, committed suicide, overdosing on laudanum, a method of suicide she learned from her mother's diary. Exactly 2 months later, Percy's first wife, Harriet, committed suicide as well, drowning herself in the Serpentine River. Her suicide was prompted by many aggravations, the most recent of which was learning that Percy had pimped Jane, Mary's stepsister, to his friend Lord Byron, and that Jane had become pregnant. Mary and Percy wed, and Mary lived in a small, damp apartment on the Thames. Here she gave birth to a third child, but Percy rarely saw the child because he was constantly out of the house, avoiding creditors. This is the condition under which Mary wrote the book Frankenstein. The book will make no sense if you don't know this. It will seem like a horror story, a science fiction story, when in fact it's eerily autobiographical. Perhaps we all know the story of Frankenstein. A young man, Victor Frankenstein, sews a bunch of body parts together, creates a new human being secretly, abandons it, and spends the rest of his life tormented by the monster who slowly kills off every person Victor loves. With no knowledge of the author, Frankenstein might seem like typical romantic screed against science. In believing he can grant mankind some sublime progress, Victor peers into the mysteries of nature where he ought not and unleashes a monster. The bleakness of his mortuary lab is easily contrasted with the splendor of nature, which he's ever seeking as a respite from the beaker and burner. However, Mary Shelley was a young woman beset by suffering and emotional trauma born out of romantic convictions. She suffered because the men she was with were romantics. Percy could not be bound by civic institutions like marriage. His spirit was free to go where it pleased, as was his body. This irresponsibility led to Mary's malnourishment and likely the death of her child. Percy never committed himself to her, while she remained wholly committed to him. To read Frankenstein is to read a deeply angry, thinly veiled biography. Mary's not much interested in critiquing science through the character Victor. Now, she writes this story of what happens when a child is conceived outside the bonds of marriage. The reader of Frankenstein is left to wonder what was so wrong with the old way of doing things that a man must cut up the dead, piece them back together, and then animate it. Victor Frankenstein is a man terrified by human relationships, by the messiness of human relationships. He was raised in a bubble so insular and so tiny that his parents tell him as a child that he ought to marry his sister. Closed off from the world, from the possibility of openness and relationship, Victor sets about creating a child on his own terms. In just the same way, Percy was a man terrified by the demands of fidelity. Mary describes the havoc and horror entailed in giving up fidelity, vow, sacrament, troth. That's all lost if you reduce it to romanticism. The romantic ideals of Percy and the young William Godwin make monsters of men, children abandoned, women abandoned, everyone left to their own devices. In his book Monsters of the Id, E. Michael Jones claims that on their first trip to Europe, Percy had a copy of the Marquis de Sade's Justine, a pornographic novel which follows a young Catholic woman abducted on her way to a convent, raped, and then struck by lightning and killed in the final chapter. It seems likely Mary found this book as they traveled, read it, and understood the brave new world of both the Enlightenment and the Romantics. In discarding marriage, sacrament, and ethics in favor of rationality and pure freedom, both had thrown the spiritual aspect of man on a junk heap. Stripped of spirit, man was simply a machine. Some humans were machines of change in government. Some were machines of pleasure. In the novel Frankenstein, the first woman to die is the absolutely innocent, chaste young Catholic girl named Justine, who goes to her execution baffled at the cards and Cosmos has dealt her. Victor has ample opportunity to save her, to describe her innocence, but he's simply too ashamed and embarrassed and cowardly to do so. I could go on. But suffice to say that Frankenstein has 1,000 angles and Mary's biography has 1,000 angles, and they both reflect and refract one another again and again. The teacher who stages an encounter between Mary and their students by way of Frankenstein can present a rich interplay between fact and fiction, between the actual and the ideal. When a book like this is truncated, reduced to mere exemplar of romantic propositions, all this is gone. It's lost. The book is a different book if read from a relational, personal, Trinitarian, and incarnational worldview, though. The reader learns to sympathize with Mary, but not to envy her sin. In coming to know Mary deeply, the characters of the book are known deeply, and the book is not simply read, but understood from the inside out. It is this kind of encounter with a book that inspires a student to love reading and to love knowing and to comprehend how a deep relationship blossoms into deep knowledge. Thank you very much. Just a few minutes left for questions. The last book I mentioned was Monsters of the Id by E. Michael Jones. E. Michael Jones' Monsters of the Id is a rather fascinating Christian account of horror, whether it's Ridley Scott's Aliens, Dracula, it's like a broad survey of fiction horror and a Christian account of it. Sir? Well, that's a fine question. If you read a decent biography of Mary Shelley, you're going to be able to speak of the basic demographics of her life, where she was born and so on and so forth. But her diary is such a remarkable glut of information. There's always these, if you read her diary, you find all of these little moments that resurface in the book. For instance, most people don't know this, Frankenstein was a real person. He had a large castle in Germany that Mary Shelley visited with Percy. And the character Victor Frankenstein is named after this real guy at a real place that she actually met. That's a kind of interesting detail that grants credibility to the story as it's coming out. So, if you read the book, Victor Frankenstein isn't a character that appears until almost 15, 20 pages in. That would be a great detail to say for 15, 20 pages. Yeah. Yeah, you always have to leave something out. Of course. With somebody in 7th or 8th grade, I think something important about the biographical stuff is don't test it. Don't test and quiz. Biography tends to just be a large number of facts. And if you're asking for what year did this happen, what year did that happen, then the students are going to hate biographies. Then it's just going to be this dumb thing we have to do. And I really just want to read the story. So when the biography is done well, it is the story. There's no biography. It's simply the story from a different angle. And so to answer your question, which is an excellent question, at the point that the students are biography stuff. That's probably a point at which they're disengaging, and you can recognize your own you're being a little too esoteric, you know, if you're a little too pedantic, if they're not enjoying the biography stuff. I would say 9 times out of 10, they love the biography stuff. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes. I'll leave this final thought with you. Thank you all for your patience. In the foreword to Thomas Wolfe's novel, Look Homeward, Angel, he says all fiction is autobiographical. I believe that's true. Whether it's Star Wars or Enchanted April, it's all about people. It's all about the person who wrote it. And that's why I think that incorporating the biography into the text is the only way to be fair. Very kind. Thank you all very much.